that it is quite necessary in this first parliament that we bring together all churches in attempt to win provincial legislatures, finance committees, COPA, local government, under this roof, to begin to then establish a relationship with the Office of the Auditor General, with an objective, of course, of fostering a relationship that will ensure that as we move forward in this fourth parliament, we then build that kind of a relationship wherein we, as members of parliament, together with the Office of the Auditor General, will be better positioned and better equipped to do or to execute our primary responsibility, which is oversight. And of course, it is important that as members of parliament, in doing that task, we need the necessary tools to do that. And the Office of the Auditor General therefore becomes quite strategic and important to play that role of empowering us as members of parliament in doing or executing our primary task, which is oversight. It is with that, honourable members, that I welcome you, the Auditor General, Mr. Terence Nombem, and everybody. Of course, we also have a representative from the Office of National Treasury, Mr. Freeman Nomba, would also be part of this particular important exercise, where and when, or as and when there are issues, of course, where you find it necessary to then intervene and share information, you'll be welcome to do that. Honourable members, this is the day of the Auditor General, but before that, let me give the House Chairperson for committees and in oversight in the NA, Honourable Mapela, to give us a contextual understanding of why we are here today. Honourable Mapela.
Thank you, House Chairperson Dow, and good morning, Chairpersons and the whips that are here, and I know that there's media also. You are all welcome. The main mission of Parliament, as you all know, is to build an effective people's parliament that is responsive to the needs of the people and that is driven by the ideal of realizing a better quality of life for all people of South Africa. And its mission is to represent and act as a voice of the people in fulfilling Parliament's constitutional functions of passing the laws and overseeing the executive. The central theme of our oversight and accountability model, and I quote, says, a true test of democracy is to what extent does Parliament ensure that government remains accountable to the people by maintaining oversight on its actions. Close quote. The new mechanism also that arose out of that process was the new bill which has now been passed into law. It's called the Money Amendment and Related Matters Act, which gives powers to amend the budget or reject it. Committees can use it by recommending to the Appropriation Committee now, which has been established, should there be a need really to want to amend the budget or even to reject, and then you'll therefore be having that particular status under the new Act. Also, the new mechanism that are arising from the oversight model is the sanctioning of the executive should they fail to comply with the adopted reports from the committees themselves or any other recommendation that might arise from the committee as will be adopted by the National Assembly. So those are the mechanisms that are there. We are also included in the mechanisms in the track and monitoring of issues, referral, follow-up, and then report as would arise from any work of Parliament. will also be creating a budget office to assist committees and give some expert advice on the analysis of the budgets themselves, and then the committees will be using that budget office in addition to the appropriation committee to really begin to empower them so that they will then exercise their oversight. We'll also be strengthening and utilizing up to the optimal level all tools of oversight, such as the quarterly reports that comes from the executive, the annual reports, as it's now the season, the end of August, beginning of September, all annual reports will be presented to Parliament. We have also agreed in one of the chairperson's committee's meetings 2 years ago that the annual performance report ought to be submitted to Parliament also, because that's where departments are able to identify whether they are still going to be able to deliver on a particular program or not. It's not in the AR, the annual report. It's mainly put in the annual performance report. So committees ought to then look at those particular issues. So the Auditor General today will then be informing us about how they execute their mandate as an oversight body on issues of finances, expenditure in the particular, and what arises out of the audit report that continuously gets submitted to Parliament and then gets published. So we'll then be looking at that particular tool and sharpening our role around that particular tool, as the chairperson has already indicated. These are in addition to other oversight mechanisms, such as asking quality questions, member statements, motions, and so forth. The objective of this meeting, therefore, is to understand the mandate of the AG as one of the bodies with oversight powers and functions. The second one is what reports is the AG producing and how committees can use them in their oversight work. Currently, the culture in Parliament is to only leave the public accounts committees to be the only one that looks at those particular reports. But we want the committees themselves to then begin to really look at issues that are within their own portfolio related matters, and then begin to identify those issues, engage the ministers and engage the department around some of those particular issues. Also, we'll be sharpening this tool of oversight towards an engaging and robust parliament as it assesses its authority and mandate in as far as oversight is concerned. The other objective is to receive information on recent audits of municipalities, the provincial departments, and the entities that the Auditor General has just recently released. We'll also ensure that the committee understands and begins to effect accountability on the executive using this particular audit report. We'll also use the session to build capacity for committees on effecting financial accountability. Oversight entails, as you all know, the formal and the informal. It has an element of surprise. Sometimes it does go into a place, observe, and come back without giving notice to those people. It has an element of watchful, and as others will see, the watchdog on strategic and it has a structured scrutiny type of a process. So it happens usually at the committee level. The concept of oversight also contains aspects which include political oversight, administrative oversight, not really looking at whether there are ball pens and writing pens, more about the application. When a person walks into the Home Affairs offices, what type of reception do they go through? Are they being well received, well processed, and so forth? So those are the administration applications. It also looks at financial aspects. It also looks at ethical issues. It also looks at legal and strategic goals. And these are all the issues that have been raised in the oversight module in the manner in which we will be. So today our focus obviously will be more on the audit, which relates more to the financial issues. The functions of our oversight include detect and prevention of abuse, the arbitrary behavior of illegal and unconditional conduct on the part of the executive and all agencies. We also ensure that we hold a government to account in respect of how the taxpayer's money is used. It detects the waste and improves on the efficiency and effectiveness utilization of the public resources. And this I'm just quoting from the oversight module. on the final conclusion, I will then say that all the three arms of state, and I think that's just to remind everyone, the parliament, the executive, and the judiciary have distinct mandates. They are independent, but interrelated, without encroaching in each other's territory, but are enjoined at the same time to achieve the same goals of a better life for all. So they are distinct mandates, they are independent, but they are interrelated. And this is just a constitutional aspect, and then also the constitution goes further to say you are all enjoined in that distinct, independent, and interrelated relation to achieve a better life for all our people, governed by the corporation, cooperative government, and the intergovernmental relations as legislated. Like in a soccer game, oversight should have a fair play. They say don't play the men, but play the ball. However, it is an offense for any coach to be standing on top of the ball, as you will get a yellow card in any soccer game. It is an applicable offense, as you know, if you stand, and you can ask Dr. Kumalo what happened to you when we played with Brazil. But if you continuously stand on the ball, becomes a second gable offense, then a red card is issued. Never be caught on top of the ball. Those who try to kick the ball will do so and you'll fall very hard. But that does not mean you become enemies and adversaries. We just ensure that indeed you exercise your oversight function in that particular way. Thank you very much, Chair. I think that's the main and the objective of today's meeting, and I think the Auditor General is really going to take it from. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Bapena. I would take it that maybe there are some points that members would have loved to make or question, but let us take the Auditor General and whatever comments you would want to make on the contextual basis of this particular workshop. We'll then do that as we engage with the report as presented by the Auditor General. Auditor General, it's your turn. Sorry for the alarm. Thank you indeed, Chair. And thank you to the honorable members for making the time available this morning to be part of the dialogue, which dialogue I believe is going to take us forward as a country. This is a session that comes at the back of a similar engagement with the third parliament, where upon presenting our consolidated general report, we highlighted and emphasized quite a number of issues that needed to be considered, and a number of issues that we agreed we will jointly pursue between the Office of the Auditor General as well as the chairpersons of the committees of Parliament. This also is a session that is meant to then revisit some of those key and specific undertakings, which are not many, but I believe are very clear and decisive in terms of what it will take to transform our governance, as well as take it to a position where we have a clean government in South Africa. I also just want to state up front that today we would not presenting a report per se, but to rather strengthen, as the Chair has said, the relationship that we need to forge ahead in order that when we present the report, we're able to then formulate a mechanism by which we will deal with that report to make sure that its intended actions are taken seriously. And on that note, the first message I just want to leave is that we will be summarizing the report of the PFMA audits, which have just been completed a few weeks ago. And while the departments are ready, rather busy with the preparation of out of their annual reports, we will also be consolidating those audit results such that by the end of September, we should have had an opportunity to meet with this gathering again to brief you on the essence of those reports. So I do trust, Chair, that the first message for today is to find a date wherein, before we go to the provincial roadshow, we're able to look at the consolidated results of the national department as well as the highlights of the results of the provinces. After which, we will then embark on a national roadshow that will take us to all the provinces to share those results with each province as well. I do trust that as part of that engagement, we will have an opportunity to identify a level of interest from the members as to which jurisdictions they would like to join us as part of those provincial roadshows. By then, we will have the dates that would have been confirmed with regard to the provincial legislature briefing. So that's the first message, Chair. The second issue I just want to touch on today is the first point that we have highlighted. Before I even go further into talking about the issues of specific substance, let me talk about who we are, what we do, so that in response to that specific expectation that you raised in your presentation, Chair, I make sure that I fulfill that responsibility. With regard to who we are, we are an institution that is mandated by the Constitution in Chapter 9 to audit all state organs or all organs that are funded by state revenue and then report on the results of those audits to the oversight. And as part of our audit, I just want to also highlight that we don't necessarily audit ourselves all those state institutions. But what we do is to set standards that will provide guidance on how those institutions should be audited. An example is the fact that we will audit perhaps all the government departments, but we will not necessarily audit all the public entities that fall under each of the government departments. But the standards that we set are such that the private firms that audit those institutions should audit in keeping with our guidelines. So then what we will then do, which we are in the process of perfecting, it's not as perfect as it should be, is to then review the work that's done by those private firms to confirm that indeed, in concluding their audit, they have audited in line with what we expect them to have done. And in that respect, we will in future, not this year, but in the near future, let's say in the next year or two, be able to report holistically on how the state institutions have been audited, either by us or by the private firms, because I think it's immaterial who audits them as long as the standards that are used to audit them are those that we establish as the Auditor General. And then provide assurance to Parliament that everything that has been audited has been audited in keeping with what your expectations are. I'm addressing that point, Chair, because there is always an expectation that is raised wherever we go that the standards by which some of the institutions are audited differ from the manner in which we audit those institutions that we audit ourselves. So I just want to provide that assurance that we are addressing that particular feedback and observation and concern, and in a matter of a few months we would be able to respond favorably to that expectation, which has been a useful feedback to us indeed. Now, as part of those audits, our coverage is meant to be multiple-fold. We would do the financial audit, which look at the financial statements and the extent to which they are a true reflection of what is in the accounting record of the department and entities. Secondly, we will look at the extent of compliance with the applicable legislation for each and every government entity that we audit, just to make sure that they have carried out their mandate and activities in keeping with the prescribed legislation that informs and formulates that particular government department or entity. So that, and then we'll issue a conclusion in that respect. The third area that we have been piloting over the last 5 years together with the National Treasury under the leadership of the Accountant General has been the most significant aspect of our auditing. And that is the auditing of the performance information of all government departments and state entities. That will entail our ability to confirm that all the service delivery objectives and promises and reports that are put before Parliament and legislatures are a true reflection of what actually happened. At the moment, we are not in a position to make a conclusion, but in a matter of a few months, once again, not this year, but maybe in the next year or two, we'll be able to make that particular conclusion decisively. And that will round up our initiative to provide the most comprehensive audit that we can ever provide in order to provide a holistic assurance that that is contained in the annual report, be it financial information, as well as that is contained in the body of the annual report or performance report, as the Chair of Chairs has mentioned, is worthy of being looked at and examined by the oversight. So that is, will be the next step that will be happening. But up to now, we've only been auditing the financial and compliance information and making conclusions with regard to those. The next audit that we do and will continue to do is what we call performance audit. And I want here to emphasize that a performance audit, because sometimes a confusion does happen between a performance audit and the audit of performance information. But a performance audit is something different. It's something that we cannot do on an annual basis. Whereas the audit of performance information we will do every year, and every time we report, every time the departments and entities present their annual reports, you will get the assurance that what you are looking at is worthy of being looked at. Right. But the performance audit is something that will be done more on a cyclical basis, and the topics and the choice thereof will differ from the priorities that the nation may prescribe, and the nation is the representation of yourself the executive and any other stakeholders that may make inputs in terms of where the priorities should be. And other sources of reference in terms of the priorities naturally will be informed by the State of the Nation Address and many other forums that may inform what the national priorities ought to be. And those performance audits will therefore seek on a cyclical basis to confirm that the monies that are spent on those issues of primary national priority, those monies are spent in an efficient, effective, and economical manner, which is something slightly different from the other audits that we would have performed. Even though on the performance information side, and excuse me for using this term interchangeably, I appreciate that, it's very confusing. Even though on the performance information side, the Treasury has emphasized that in putting together your objectives, in executing your mandate, you should always bear in mind and take cognizance of the issues of economy, issues of efficiency, issues of effectiveness of the use of your resources. And then we've extended that to the fourth E, which is the issue of equity. So in the guideline that Treasury has produced in terms of the government information and how it should be rolled out right across government, there are clear guidelines in that respect, and I do trust that Freeman, that document is readily available and now a public document to all the government sectors, including the oversight. But if it is not, I think it's a document that is worthy of being looked at. It's a document that is very insightful and informative indeed, and can help oversight in terms of not exercising its work with regard to the compliance with those four E's, so to speak. But on our side, we will tend to audit those more intensely when we do the performance audit. All right. But during the question and answer session, perhaps one can clarify more some of those conceptual issues and definitions around those audits. So those are the kind of audits that we will ordinarily perform. Now, from time to time, and as and when there is a need in terms of our assessment of the risk of government, we will undertake some of the investigations. From time to time, those will be triggered by special requests from the department. Some of them tend to be triggered by the requests from the oversight. But by and large, I think it's important to highlight that in commissioning an investigation, because it's a highly expensive exercise sometimes, we always, as a first point, confirm that the issues that are worthy of being investigated have adequately been covered as part of our annual regularity audits. Because those audits do require of us to exercise our professional excellence in assessing the risk of fraud, error, corruption, etc., as part of our annual audit. And in most instances, when those requests come, they normally come at a point where the commentator may not be aware of the work we've done as part of our annual audit. And our responsibility then in that respect is always to confirm and use that information as a basis of further evaluation of the risks of the department, and then incorporate those requests as part of our annual audit, because that's the benefit that we have as an audit office. We are always there with the department. We're always auditing departments on an annual basis. Therefore, to have to conduct and commission a special audit based on a special request tends to not to be necessary, because it's always part and parcel of what you do anyway in the government department. And it's only in rare and exceptional cases that we commission a special separate audit that we report separately on. That is when there's the need now to conduct an investigation, because there has been a confirmation the confirmation of the existence or allegation of fraud, error, or corruption. And in those instances, the judge also wants to inform the house that those are the conclusions we also are expected to make anyway, so that as part of our annual report, you can see that in this environment, the risk of fraud, error, and corruption is prevalent. And it then becomes a question of what do we do with that? So those are the types of audits that we do conduct from time to time. Chairs, I think it's at this point that it will be appropriate then to speak in a manner that will help you to understand who from time to time is behind those audits. Who is responsible for conducting these audits on an annual basis or ad hoc basis, as the case may be. So as part of the introduction of the office, it would be worthy to understand that the Auditor General is not a singular body that runs its audits. It has got an institution that is composed of, in terms of our Public Audit Act, the Deputy Auditor General, whose responsibility it is to run the institutions and execute all these things that we talk about. So that as the Auditor General, one is able to then take those results and present them to the oversight, present them to all those that are charged with governance. And that becomes, at a leadership level, our primary area of preoccupation, to engage with those charged with governance, to make sure that the outcome of our report gets taken seriously, gets acted upon, and we see the momentum in a positive direction in terms of clean government in South Africa. And it is in this respect that the mission that we have, the reputation promise that we hold of building public confidence through our audit is based on. Because without that public confidence being constantly nurtured, we're going to have a situation of anarchy in this country. That's why we position our niche within the constitutional responsibility that we're mandated to fulfill. So, Kimi Mabwetu would stand up so that you can see who he is, those that don't know him. He is the Deputy Auditor General of South Africa. Within his team, he has got what we call the head of audit, someone whose responsibility it then becomes to coordinate all these bodies that I've been talking about and the report on time and on a quality and meaningful manner on the results of our constitutional mandate. And that is a lady by the name of Gillian Bailey. If you can stand up, Gillian, so that they can see you. Gillian has got an interesting background in the sense that he has been with the regulator, that is the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, for many, many years. She, yes. And as part of that responsibility, she has been responsible for quality control and assurance right across the profession. And it has been an important inheritance for us as an office to have someone of that stature who understands auditing from the standards that's required to be adhered to someone who understands how to evaluate the adherence to those standards, and has been doing that for more than a decade as part of the regulator of South Africa. Supporting GDN as part of the office support services that make sure that the audit teams do their audits effectively in a manner that is technologically sound, in a manner that is human resource efficient, in a manner that is efficient in terms of our relationship with stakeholders, you name it. Anything to do with anything we do in the office other than auditing is Linda Lachabapa. We call her the corporate chief operating officer. Linda Lachabapa. She's our crew, or chief operating officer. Those are the people that are the pillars of strength for the deputy auditor general to then drive these priorities that I've spoken to you about to excellence. Now I'm going to move down the ladder of the audit business. And these are the people that now you are most likely to interact with regularly as part of the execution of the oversight. And these are the people that would have been champions of delivering this audit report. And there are five of them. They will be part of your documentation, but I think it's important that you know who they are. Some of the documentation that you'll have, and I'm not sure whether you got that information, but if you don't, you will soon have it. Their portfolios will be clearly defined so that you know how to access them, but obviously they will be the first ones to contact you. First of all, Barry Wheeler is one of our, we call this team corporate executives. That's where the buck stops when it comes to auditing. It doesn't go beyond that level. So anything to do with auditing in that institution, that's where the buck stops. What GDN does is basically coordinating and marshalling and guiding and leading and working and motivating that team. We call them the big five, so to speak, here. So Barry is the first of the big five. Then followed by Eugene Zungu. Maybe it's easier, but remain standing until I finish introducing him. Followed by, are you all there? Alice Muller. I'm just checking if they're there before I call their names. Followed by, there's someone missing. What's the order? Okay. Followed by Paul Serote. Paul Serote could not be with us today. And then lastly, Pramesh Bana. So these are the people that you will always interact with when it comes to audit issues. Just sit down, ladies and gentlemen. So one of our missions here today, Chair, has been then to respond to your specific request, which is to introduce who we are, what we do, etc. So that's our team, and that's what we do. And that's the team that all the committee members, chairs, nationally and provincially, as well as local government, are dependent on that five-person team to engage to take our country forward in terms of clean government. Now, the last point I just want to touch on relates to now, having introduced what we do,
having introduced who we are, what have been the recent revelations in the report that we have tabled? You would have the public documents in the form of our general report, both at national level and provincial level. I think we have tabled recently those reports in every legislature, and I would imagine that even the provincial general report would be available at a national level. So there's a myriad of information that is available to make reference to. That information is equally available in our website as well, so there's no shortage of sources to access that information. Recently, we have also tabled a general report for local government for the year ended June, I think 2008. So that information is also available in the website as well. So, and that's the information I want us to talk about and say what in essence is contained in those reports. Because in those reports, what you are seeing as a common trend, whether it's in national government, whether it's in provincial government, whether it's in the local government, there are three specific challenges that we see. Yes, we may have picked up that there are errors here and there are challenges here and there that make us not to issue a clean report for departments or entities. But we have taken the trouble to go deeper than that and to understand what is it that gives rise to these repetitive findings that make us to be concerned about the state of cleanness of our governance. And these matters we have raised last year, so they are not new matters, but in the interest of this being a new parliament, we will repeat them again. And we're going to reflect on them again towards the end of September, beginning of October, once we find a date to reflect on what migration have we seen since the last 2 years. So the roots of those problems and what we believe needs to be addressed. Because the symptoms will always come and go, they will chop and change, but the root of the issues has proven to remain constant. There are three things that we need to attend to. And the portfolio committees are well positioned, we believe, to deal with these issues. In conjunction with the public accounts committees, in conjunction with any other structures of oversight that could attend to these issues. The reality that we face in South Africa is that if we're looking at having proper financial information, we need to have people that understand finances. Our assessment is that the quality of financial skills, financial discipline, financial execution in every department that we have got a concern with is rather weak and shaky. There are nevertheless pockets of excellence here and there, particularly at a national level. There's a much more broader availability of those skills, but as we go down to provincial level, we find them here and there. When you go down to our local government, it becomes more thinner and thinner and thinner. But overall, that's what we need to build. And therefore, strategically, as a nation, as an oversight, I heard the chair speaking about the new legislation that now influences the budget priorities for oversight. If there's one area that needs to be given priority, is the ability to look at the creation and the nurturing of those skills within the public service and make the public service a preferred choice for such skills. If it's not a preferred choice for such skills, create an environment where those skills could be developed and nurtured at an appropriate level, obviously. We're not looking here at professionals that are highly qualified in every instance. We're looking here at basic ability to live up to the discipline of good accounting and finances, to the minutest level of even being able to keep a document when you're academic, because these are the kind of things we see. The inability to keep records, the inability to process those records through the financial system. And these do not require in any way the extended skill set. The ability to guide people to be able to keep an orderly environment when it comes to finance. Naturally, for those to happen, there may be a consideration of some systems that will make that easy to happen, etc., etc. But that's what we need to look at. I guess during September we can look more into those issues once we're looking at the actual results. The second area that requires attention, if you are to channel our budget priorities effectively, is an area of looking at the governance support structures within government. Here I'm talking about a regularly spoken about prevalence of good internal auditors in the country, regularly spoken about need to have effective audit committees. And these are the ingredients that have made many other countries that have got clean governance to sustain that situation. These are the ingredients that have made countries that have been in country private sector that have had clean governance to sustain that situation. And therefore, public sector, in our instance, is no exception. And those entities that have had immense success in terms of the cleanness of their governance have mastered the art of getting good internal auditors and effective audit committees. So our challenge is, how do we get to a point where we can influence people as leadership to want to provide a service of that nature, especially audit committees, to the public service? There may not be a significant amount of shortage when it comes to those skills. They are, I would believe, available in abundance in the private sector, available in abundance in retirement homes. They are available in abundance in holiday homes, those that have retired early, and anywhere else that we can look at in South Africa. We've got those skills in abundance, but our ability to attract them to the public service may not have been as focused and as concentrated as it should have been to strengthen our migration towards clean government. Internal audit, obviously, with the strengthening of the National Treasury coordination, is something that could be given a lot of impetus. Because if you look at both the strengthening of the accounting environment and the internal audit environment, both provincial and national treasuries will need to be given an enormous amount of capacity to coordinate, monitor, and evaluate the strength of those skills. And lastly, as a third priority, the interest and commitment of the leadership. None of these two issues will ever happen unless the leadership is interested to make them happen. None of these issues will ever take root unless the leadership is aware of the gravity of the challenge that it faces, and then make every effort to channel resources and commitments to make sure that they happen. And in those instances where the leadership has demonstrated that interest and commitment, we have seen sustainable results in the right direction. And it is in this interest and on this note that our meeting here today is I think it's important, first and foremost, relevant, as well as opportune. Because this is where we have the opportunity to say as an oversight leadership, yes, the executive will have to play its own role. To what extent are we going to drive this particular agenda tirelessly and consistently until we see the results? Ours will be consistently to then monitor the extent to which there is progress and mobility based on the influence and the drive that we see from yourselves as an oversight leadership. We will nevertheless also engage with yourselves on an ongoing basis. And that's why the five people that stood in front of you for that reason, to be able to be available to you in monitoring this information and giving you feedback on an ongoing basis. Together with obviously their teams, their business executives, etc., right across the country. So those are the three issues that I thought we should apply our minds on today in terms of how we take this issue forward. Chair, lastly, none of this will ever happen unless as oversight we've got resource capacity and research capacity and coordinating capacity to have this information. On our side, we believe that these three simple things don't require an enormous amount of research. As an institution, we do a lot of research, we do a lot of analysis, we present information on the table in a very, hopefully, simplistic manner, detailed manner, because if you look at those reports, if you want to look at each and every department, each and every entity, and look at the state of how they feature in terms of those three issues, it's there. By department, by entity, all 450 or whatever the number they are, they're in that general report. If you look at the local government report, every municipality, you will have a sense of where they stand with regard to those issues. So the information is not unavailable. The question of now, how do you act on that to then engage with those entities to make sure that there is progress. And the ability then to coordinate our work with those of public accounts committees is going to be critically important, because the tendency is to relegate exclusively issues of finance to the public accounts committees. And then when we meet as the portfolio committee, it becomes a different agenda. All we're saying is, let's match those agendas. Because the underlying root of the collapse of progress in service delivery is the ability to manage the finances effectively. And therefore, as a portfolio committee, it's critically important that we make that our priority as well, and collaborate and coordinate with the public accounts committee until this thing is resolved. So, Chair, that's the message I thought I could leave with you here today. It's essentially, I suppose, threefold. One is the date for the next meeting. Secondly, the what we do and what we continue to do with you in terms of what we audit and what the key results have been. Thirdly and lastly, what we need to do together in conjunction with the public accounts committee and the portfolio committee to make sure that we make a difference. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, AJ. Members, you would note that according to the program we had, at this moment we should have had a presentation by the Deputy AG, Mr. Makwetu, but the extent to which the Auditor General dealt with the issues, he's quite comfortable that the issues have been incorporated in the presentation by the AG. So what we then do, we would allow questions, we would allow input, and then the team is here, they will then respond as a collective to whatever areas that we find to be quite glaring.
I must just make a request. Maybe I'm also guilty of that. We are informed that the microphones are not up to standard, so we should avoid speaking directly to the mic to avoid that public sound, because it has got a negative effect in terms of the recording process. So maybe I'm also addicted to that. Yeah, I just try to avoid speaking directly to the mic because that public sound has a negative effect. I'm going to open up for issues for discussions, questions, or whatever. And of course, my apology. Because we've got members also from provincial legislatures and so forth, I may not know their names, so I want to apply one standard rule of not calling anybody by name, but by your honorable title, so that you don't feel less important.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Mike Tarr. I'm the Chairman of Scope in KwaZulu-Natal. Chair, I just wanted to ask something relating to orders of performance and information. And I think my question is captured in one short paragraph in the AG's report on page 11, the last paragraph on page 11. There's just three lines, if I could read it, Chair. The solid compliance base demonstrated by the majority of national departments should be used as a basis for the design and development of clearer and more concise performance indicators. Now, my question really is, Chair, that it would be of huge use if, let's say, this process of developing performance indicators that were measurable and talk to the strat plans and departments was available, because we could then far more closely interrogate performance indicators or performance of departments when they appear before us. Because the present strat plans or performance plans of departments, they are really not very helpful. They give you output, they give you input, which all relate to internal functioning of departments, but very few of them that talk directly to their strat plans, and even fewer that are actually measurable. And I'm wondering when we can look forward to a universal set of these measures being developed for the different departments that are perhaps uniform across provinces. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, my name is Chris Ntuli. I would like to check, Chairperson, from the auditor, General. Why do you outsource some of your auditing work? Well, is it because of the capacity? Are you a small, numbers? Cannot be able to do the job yourself, or is it a strategy to achieve a certain objective? Secondly, if there is no compliance from the department, then what? Let's say they don't comply with your request and report, then what action? I mean, is it supposed, then what?
I saw a hand. Okay, another member.
I listen carefully. My name is Stone Sizan. I'm chairperson of the Rural Development and Land Reform Committee of Parliament. I listen carefully to what the Auditor General is saying about the regularity and performance audit. But I find it very difficult to understand why the audits that were conducted in Free State concluded that the Department of Education in Free State had tolerated the culture of corruption in that department for a long time. how does it set in if these audits are as what the auditor general is saying?
The last one, the third, and then I'll get to the third. Okay, honourable member.
No, sir. Too last. I'm not convinced. I find this argument of lack of skill or skilled people with finances sometimes being just a scapegoat. Why I'm saying that? How do we realize this thing 10, 15 years and we've always been talking about? How come that we just realize this thing only after 15 years? Because the question I've been asking myself, how long does it take to train an accountant? Let alone talking about financial clerks or administrators. Because some of these things, it's not about very high technical people, or you're talking about chartered accountants, you're talking about just how you keep your records sometimes. So how long does it take to train those people? And my argument is that there's a tendency that we do not want to go into some of the sensitive issues because of the nature of the position of some of the people. Failure of management in the public service is a serious issue. The top management who are highly paid, that's the issue. You cannot, year in, year out, talking about lack of skill. What's wrong in the department to come up and draw up their own program in terms of how they are going to identify people and plow them in certain institutions? Then after 4 or 5 years, those people are ready. Or maybe a municipality to say, we will take a conscious decision to identify particular children who must be trained in this particular field, and we are going to do it through a particular institution, and then after that they are ready to work for this municipality. For how long are we going to be talking about lack of the skill and so on? And we do not talk about management, which is failing day in, day out. I'm not very convinced when it comes to this particular argument. Because we talk as if we're talking about rocket scientists to produce those people who are supposed to be doing that work.
Thank you very much, sir. I'll take 5 this side and then allow the AG to respond, and then we'll take another round again. Honourable member.
My name is Hope Babu. I'm the chair of the Housing Legislature Finance Portfolio Committee. The issue I wanted to raise the AG is that in the provinces we have the business executives, which are provincial offices of the AGs. And one of their responsibilities is the work with the SCOPA committees, the committee of SCOPA to deal with annual financial audit. They also obviously have to work with the treasury. And one of the responsibilities of provincial treasuries is to assist municipalities to implement municipal finance management acts. Now, and we also have the Department of Local Government, which also has a constitutional responsibility to assist municipalities. Now, one of the critical things is called effective coordination of all these efforts. Now, in doing all this, I mean, the recommendation you just made, the issue around capacity, I mean, we had instances the reports of a municipality which hires a geography teacher to be a CFO. This person has never studied accounting, even in high school. Now, how then do we deal with a situation like that when this has happened? In terms of the work of Parliament, will this really cross maybe what Member Nesi was raising, cross direction of a duty by the person who employs that person? If it's a municipal manager who employs this kind of a person to deal with finances, I think this is, unless maybe that work is going to be auctioned out to somebody with a friend, maybe, to run the finances of that municipality or department. I think it's one of the issues that we need to really begin to focus. Who are the people who get employed to deal with finances? I know you are raising the issue of credit, debit, balancing of books, day-to-day running of them. Those basic things which have to happen. Something not being put on the table and said, I'll see you tomorrow, and then the document has disappeared. And I think it's one area which for your committees we need to focus on, both in our departments, in municipalities, because if we don't do that, there's no way we're going to have clean audits. I mean, disclaimers 15 years after election, after the democracy, that's not on.
Thank you very much, honorable member.
Thank you, another.
No. Can I just hold it? Just hold it a bit.
Thank you, Chairperson. That looks as surprised how the Free State is leading. Chairperson, I just want to ask what is the general. You mentioned the phrases of credibility of audit reports, also to build public confidence in audit. But if you now take what happens in the Free State, the Department of Education received unqualified audit reports for the last 2 years. And then when we get a private audit company to look into matters, we find these type of reports which were not picked up by the Auditor General. Now, my question is, are these audit reports really credible? And does it really build public confidence if the Auditor General is unable to pick up the level of fraud and misconduct that was picked up by a private audit company in the Free State? So if I can just respond on that, thank you.
Honourable Member.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just not sure what does this mean. I need clarity. Like, if you find that the municipality on 2006-2007 audit, they were not qualified, but there were other methods. And the same thing happened in 2007-2008. A municipality is not qualified, but those other methods exist. What does that mean? Because if there was a matter existing, should it exist forever and you still not qualified for that? Thanks.
Last two hands, honorable member, and then honorable
member,
and then we'll come.
Thank you, Chair. Let me thank Auditor General and his team for coming to us as chairs of portfolio committees. My name is Makhoso Soitu. I'm the chairperson for Water and Environmental Affairs in the National Assembly. Maybe I would like my question to what Honorable Van Rooyen from the Free State said, that at which stage does the Auditor General get involved in advising the Ministry or Parliament about investigating a certain department? Especially if a department has been getting a disclaimer or a qualified report for the past 6 to 7 years without nothing that has been done by the department, after the Auditor General gave an opinion about certain issues that were supposed to be corrected and they were never corrected. And secondly, looking at the report, it's obvious that most of the departments, national, provincial, even at local governments, received qualified or disclaimer reports. Don't you think that maybe there is a problem or a weakness in the system itself, Auditor General? How effective are our compliance and enforcement mechanisms because of the the kind of report that we is exposed to ourselves today. And also some of these issues, as the comrade has said, that you get a private firm to look into the finances of a certain department, and it discovered many things that have not been discovered or have not been picked up by Auditor General, which led to what is happening in my own department. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
Thank you very much. My name is Paula Pakati. I'm from the Eastern Cape. My question is related to the question that has just been asked by the Honourable Member. In the Eastern Cape, you have a situation where you have departments in succession not doing anything with regard to the recommendations of the Auditor General. And then what then becomes the record of the Auditor General in that regard? You also have situations where public entities under the department always have clean audits, when that is not the case with the department that is giving them funds. And you find that a very strange arrangement. But the key question is that what becomes the record of the AG or of SCOPA in situations where you have qualified audits in succession almost every year?
Okay, thank you very much, Honourable Members. Can I give the Auditor General and his team to respond, and then we'll take a second round.
Thank you, Chair. I think while I'm responding to some of the questions, I just want the Accountant General to prepare a response on the issue of the quality of performance indicators. Freeman, if you can just apply your mind to that. And maybe if you can just assist with the principle of contract work, the basis thereof, and what we seek to achieve through that strategy. I think most of the questions seemingly relate to issues which maybe I can address first and foremost, and then my team can add on if leave anything out. They are mainly twofold. One is the issue of the skills issue, choice of who we put into positions, as well as why we cannot get people that that can do the job, doing the job. And Freeman, I think if you can also add to that as well, the skills issue. Yeah. But the second transversal question relates to the issue of the meaning of our audit outcomes and the meaning of our messages in the report. These questions come in different tones and different kind of contexts. But in essence, about what are our messages in the report and what do they mean when you see these apparent contradictions, and what should we do about it? The audit office, etc., etc., especially when there's continuous repetition of these patterns. Let me first address the issue of departments having unqualified reports, but yet having incidents of fraud and corruption when someone else comes in to investigate and look into the issues. And I want to link this to the question that was made relating to what is the meaning of other matters, because this is where the crux of this issue is. And we've made a deliberate distinction of the classification of our audit outcomes. And this distinction is deliberately to separate between unqualified financial reports and clean audit reports. If you look at the national departments, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, provincially and nationally, there are only 7 departments that have got clean audit reports. And a clean audit report means that financially we were happy that your financial statements are consistent with the records that were examined. And the governance and internal control arrangement that you have is sound in terms of compliance with legislation. And there are 3 things that you put under other matters: compliance with legislation, effectiveness of the governance structures, that is internal audit and audit committees, as well as the quality of your financial records. Because some departments get unqualified financial statements, but because we allow departments, when you come in and pick up errors, to make changes in the job, so that at least the nation is not misled in terms of the financial statements, you find that there are multiple adjustments that get made during the course of the audit. And that cannot be a situation that is acceptable. Even though financial statements are now a true record after the audit intervention, but the environment in which they are prepared is such that right across the year they have been misleading. And the question of now using external auditors or the auditor general as a quality control check is what we are concerned about. And therefore, under those other matters, if you look at the report itself, you will see which departments were subjected to multiple adjustments, we call it significant adjustments during the audit. That is why we cannot therefore give those departments a status of having clean reports, even though the financial statements are true and true reflection of what eventually, after an elaborate intervention during the audit, financial statements got right. And it is in this instance that we find that where we indicate that there is consistent disregard here of the legislative framework, be it the financial management, finance management legislation or treasury regulation, or the founding legislation of the department or entity itself, we find consistent deviation from those legislations, be it the supply chain management legislation. And we highlight exactly which legislation are flouted. Sometimes where there are no internal auditors or where internal auditors are weak, where there are no external or what is called the audit committees, or they've simply been ineffective throughout across the years. These are the issues that in our book are indicators, clear, glaring indicators of a problem. And we always say in engagement with the leadership in our roadshow, pay attention to these other matters. Because even though we may not have found an error, even though we may not have found fraud, the moment we walk out of the door, something is going to pop up and become evident. After a certain period of time, something is going to emerge and become a problem. So those are clear signs and fertile ground for all these irregularities and corrupt practices, fraud, errors, etc. Therefore, those departments that have taken the trouble to respond to these other matters, I believe, are the ones that have now picked up. Through involving private firms, through involving us in some instances, through doing their own initiatives in terms of strengthening their controls, are the only ones, and few, by the way, that have been able to unearth these risks that we've been highlighting. And if you look at the list of all these departments that have got other matters, if all of them could institute an action through yourself, through the executive, of getting deeper into why is there a consistent disregard of supply chain and management legislation? Why is there a consistent ineffectiveness of internal auditors? And get deeper into that. Why is there consistent qualifications in this audit report? This is what you're going to find. And this is what we're urging this team to begin to do. Because we're going to have more of the examples that have been made of the precinct. More of the examples that have been made of instances in the Eastern Cape, etc., etc., etc. That's the campaign we need to begin to embark upon. Even in these public entities that may be deemed to be unqualified in the Eastern Cape, all of them, none of them have got a clean audit report. All of them have got issues around clean government. So we've got, as we've analyzed, a situation where we've got almost the entire provincial and national government, except for seven departments, having something to ponder and hope. And who is going to do that other than us? That's the action that we're calling everyone to begin to work upon today. So that's the interpretation of our report. With regard to the skills issue, incidentally, one of those departments that has got a clean report consistently, and hopefully this year again, Foreign Affairs, or now International Relations. And to look at what is it that they're doing right, then that can be a model example of what other departments should do. You look at the quality of the leadership that has been there, and that is there. When I walk around, go around to some of the overseas countries, I met with the ambassadors, there's nothing that they talk about how excited they are, how respectful they are of the principles of governance and making sure that their terrain, their embassies are running a clean ship. That tone comes right from the top, from the minister, from the DG, etc., etc., etc. And it's driven right through to the ambassadors. Now, how many other departments have got a situation where that tone is clear from the top, it's unambiguous? That's the example we need to take. When I talk about leadership tone, that's what I talk about. Who you put in positions responsible for certain tasks is what you talk about. The issue of a geography teacher becoming a CFO. These are the issues we talk about. Leadership has got to take primary accountability to positioning the players in positions where they can play effectively. If I use the analogy of the chair around the soccer thing, game. All right. So I think those are the issues I can say, but it's not for me today to get into the details of why people are employed in different directions or in inappropriate jobs, but this team, this committee, this leadership that has got to make sure that does not happen. Even the training of and finding people that can do jobs, especially at an elementary level, unless the leadership sets that tone level, that will never happen, both from the executive and from this side. And these things are, by the way, not impossible. They can happen almost overnight. We have been saying during the local government roadshow that the disclaimers that are multiple in nature in local government can reverse overnight, because what's required in local government and driving the disclaimer is the fact that documentation is not kept in municipalities. Whether deliberately or accidentally or otherwise, we don't know. But the culture of keeping documents is simply not there. And it surely cannot take a decade or half a decade to restore a culture of maintaining documentation so that auditors can audit. That's what you're talking about. And it does not require a chartered accountant or professional accountant to be able to do that. It requires people in the same villages where the municipalities exist to be able to do that basic elementary job. So I think that would be my roundup of the two of issues of fundamental essence that talk to the root of the problem that we have and what needs to be done to act on that. But in terms of the other question, and I guess Gideon Freeman can feel free to add yourself, Mr. Benedict, on my first response, in addition to your specific question around the outsourcing of our audit, and then Freeman on the issue of the performance indicators. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, FAG, for the opportunity to add to your response. Just quickly on the issue of the final outcome of an audit versus a subsequent recovery through a forensic investigation of fraud. What helped just to add a bit to the response of the AG, maybe the underlying consideration that we also need to take into account in evaluating why an audit arrived at a clean opinion and why a subsequent forensic investigation said something else. I think it's important to recognize that the scope of these two interventions is completely different. And if one reads an audit report says that, in my opinion, the financial statements present fairly in all material respects, meaning that if there was a transaction in a particular department that was below an amount of, let's say, 100,000, the audit of that department will still come out clean. But by the same token, if there was an instruction for a forensic audit to be performed on every single transaction with respect to expenditure on repairs and maintenance, for argument's sake, the forensic intervention is more than likely to pick that up. And I think what we normally coin this as, and I think we don't walk away from it, we accept it as a fundamental limitation of a statutory audit. So it is always possible that there will always be subsequent detailed forensic investigations that will uncover fraud that is potentially unlikely to be uncovered by an audit. And I'm saying this with due consideration of our responsibilities as auditors as well, to consider at the planning stage of an audit the risk that fraud may happen. So that when we coin our audit work, we coin it in such a way that we walk into an environment with an understanding that we need to have heightened level of vigilance, because there's always the ever-present possibility for fraud to happen. But I think the distinction needs to be acknowledged that in arriving at an audit opinion, one is reflecting on the ability of the institution to apply the accounting framework in determining what will sit in its balance sheet and in its income statement, among other things. And that's, I think, is important, so that the subsequent discovery by a forensic auditor, even if the forensic auditor came at an institution like an Enron, for example, over all of these years that these financial statements were clean in that environment, it was only when a person came in to do a specific forensic investigation that they uncovered those minute elements of fraud that were prevalent in the environment. I just wanted to underline that, each with your permission, without overextending the response to the differences between an outcome of an audit as well as the outcome of a forensic investigation. Now, on the matter which I was asked to specifically comment on, regarding why do you use some of the work that is assigned to you by the Constitution and the Public Audit Act to somebody else, the whole question about the objective of outsourcing audit work. A couple of factors that inform this, one of which is a practical element to this, that the financial year end of government is 31 March without exception, with the only exception that municipalities report to the 30th of June every year. Now, there's no doubt that with that concentration of financial year ends in two periods, the ability to resolve it continuously throughout 12 months will obviously have financial implications to start with. Now, the essence of it is that the economics of supporting an audit office will potentially not allow us to do this work all by ourselves, because our people will be in our environment and will be idle for the better part of the year when we have carried a fixed cost as an audit, trying to finance employment costs, finance buildings where we will house people, the computers that we would need to buy to get them to operate. They will only operate within a defined period. Now, what we do, we then say, other people who subscribe to the same professional standards that we apply, we subscribe to as an office, are the registered auditors and accountants who operate in the public domain within South Africa. So they are a better, reliable option to bring on board to assist us at times when they are not very busy. Because most of them audit the entire private sector, and the private sector is what financial year ends almost every month throughout the 12 months of the year. But there are times when the private audit firms are not busy. Now, it makes economic sense then for us to say, rather than have an additional 5,000 people on top of the 2,400 that we run with as a fixed pool of people throughout the country who deliver this audit, rather than have an additional 5,000 people, even before you consider the issue of skills to start with, rather than bring in an additional 5,000 people, we will pay on an agreed amount a firm that will come and do this audit work, let's say for the Department of Home Affairs, for 6 weeks. They come in, they put on the table the standards to which they adhere, they get assessed in terms of the level of quality that we should expect of them, and once they've delivered that, after we've done our own internal review of what they've delivered to us, we then pay them and they are gone. So there's no additional rental to be paid in respect of those people next month, nor do we need to buy any computers for them or pay them a salary for another 9 months. So that's the essence of it. That's why we go this option. It is an option that makes it possible for us to fulfill our constitutional obligation at a cost that we believe is economical and that it can effectively deliver on all these audits, so that by the end of July we can at least say that we have covered all audits to the extent of about 95%, which is what our current experience has been up to now. And so if we were to do it ourselves, it would probably have quite a lot of issues with regards to how much does it cost government to do the audits that we do. So those are the considerations that drive us to go this route.
Thanks, Chair. As indicated, my name is Truman Nombala, the Accountant General. I will deal with the question on audit of performance information and the question that was raised about universal indicators, and is not sometimes talking to the straight length. First and foremost, the regulatory framework that is in existence currently, I think, addresses this issue adequately through one, the budget rules and people budget. It states clearly that they need to have measurable objectives which flow from the PFMA, and they need to state this clearly. The whole format is outlined. Now, when departments present their budget to get their budget approved, I think it is important that oversight needs to question the relevance of the indicators that have been put there, and demand that meaningful indicators be put, so that there will be a better basis for evaluating this in the Act, because these budgets are presented when the department presents its strategy, and the legislative requirement is that that budget must talk to the strength plan. I know of a few departments in this audit that has just been finished that the Auditor General was raising that question of how is this report talking to your strength level. And therefore there is that check that gets done at that level as well that emphasizes this point. So I think there is sufficient, from a principle point of view, there is sufficient information that gives departments sufficient guidance in order to identify and put those indicators in their stress plans and translate those into their E&E documents and so on, and then report on these at the end of the year. But there's a second part of your question that says, when will a universal set of indicators be developed? At the moment, we have the Treasury document on performance information. We have the document that was presented, that was prepared by the President, government-wide monitoring and evaluation document. And these two documents are similar in the sense that they deal with the issue of performance information from a principle point of view. In other words, they identify what principles you need to follow in identifying those indicators that you need to do in your department. Now, you've got public works, you've got health, you've got education, you've got transport, you've got treasury, you've got minerals and energy. You've got all of these departments. Coming up with a universal set of indicators, you would not do that easily if you're going to set indicators for each of the departments. So if you do the principles that they need to follow in identifying the indicators, even if the mind has changed, the principles are still there and they will be sufficient to guide the department to do that. So there is a document that deals with this issue. And should there be any weaknesses in the document itself, I think that document can be reviewed. But currently, I think there is sufficient guidance and information in this regard. Honorable Ngozi, you are absolutely correct that some of the issues relating to the skills are really basic. And therefore, you don't need an accountant, for instance, to do that. To keep documents, the Auditor General has spoken to this. You don't need an accountant to do that. You need an employee whose job it is to undertake a certain activity related to the program for which that employee is responsible, and the discipline to keep the documents. Now, the Auditor General says we don't know the reasons why these documents are kept, and we're not going to speculate, but from an oversight perspective, if I was sitting where you are sitting, and I get in a department that has got a disclaimer, and the detail in the report of the Auditor General says that we could not find information to substantiate these that transaction, I would be very wary. In fact, I would demand that that doesn't happen the following year. I heard when the Honorable Chair was talking about the issues of oversight and so on, that there is a power to sanction executive authorities. Perhaps this matter ought to be elevated to that level so that it gets addressed, that there is no disclaimer whatsoever. That can be resolved overnight. Because all it takes is that the documents should be available. So for those kind of activities, you don't need these skills. However, yes, it's 15 years after our democracy. Yes, there is, in fact, a real case of the shortage of people. And I'll use a quick example. 2-3 years ago, we were implementing the accounting standards at local government level. We had the feeling that as National Treasury, there will be challenges in implementing the standards, and therefore we needed municipalities to give us a picture, a feel of where the challenges are going to be. And we did not get a response in the first place. We then called a meeting where we had all the municipalities in one place. We guided the process with questions. Again, the input that came from that process was very, very thin, which then suggests that the people that are in the room either do not understand the standards or, in fact, they may have challenges with accounting standards. So that is a reality. Now, that could be a reality that is informed by employing the wrong people, that could be a reality that is informed by the realization that comes out clearly in most of the audit reports in the three issues that the Audit General talks about, that leadership isn't necessarily prepared to appoint the right people for whatever reason. And therein lies the solution. Now, what we have been doing, and there's a question that you're raising around getting people, young people, and full experience to work in the various municipalities and get trained. For a number of years now, the National Treasury has, in particular with municipalities, provided an amount of money to all the municipalities under the financial management grant. And this grant is made available for municipalities to employ up to 5 interns that can then be trained, and then you can develop those skills in municipalities. The use of this grant is recording varying degrees of success. Some municipalities are taking it seriously, and it benefits the municipalities, some municipalities aren't. And apply this property. But having said that, maybe again taking a step back on the issue of the shortage of skills, there's a study that was done by the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants last year. This study estimates that in the country as a whole, the shortage of accountants is about 5,400, and that is the pool from which the public sector also has to draw the skills that it requires for the public sector. It then points out that there's a vacancy of 19,000 thereabout vacancies in this function of accounting in the country. Now, if you look in the public sector, this study shows that there's about 19% vacancy in the public sector. But this study goes further to talk about the ability of organizations to retain the skills once they've got the skills. The mobility of skills, and the public sector's ability loses 60% of the public sector institutions are unable to retain the skills. So even when you've trained people, you still have a challenge of retaining those skills as well. So the financial management grant was intended at addressing this issue. 2 years or so ago, we started the training as well at National Treasury. We've got 16 trainees at the moment to train the high level skills in financial management. And the idea here is that you get these young kids, you expose them to the public sector, they get to learn the tricks of the trade, and then they spend an additional 2 years to serve the public sector, to pay back the public sector for the opportunity to be able to be trained and develop these skills. We are looking at expanding this going forward. Of course, we started only 3 years ago, and you can't grow this exponentially immediately because you need to ensure that it becomes successful. You need to manage it properly. Over and above dealing with the challenges that the public sector is facing, you are also impacting on the lives of the people that you are training, and therefore it becomes important that you manage it properly. And recently, we have developed a capacity building model to deal with the shortage of skills in the public sector that we are working with Palama to roll out and fine tune and so on. And the impact of this is going to be realized down the line. And this is out of the realization that yes, there is a shortage of skills. But that should not be an excuse for an accounting officer when it comes before oversight to say, I can't find the skills. Because there is not a shortage of service providers that provide these particular services in the country. So to the extent that you cannot get the skills, you should not then fold your arms and say there's nothing you can do. So there can be something that can be done to deal with this issue. Again, it takes leadership that has to take the right decisions. And that leadership is both political and administrative leadership that needs to really, really take this issue seriously. A quick comment that relates to that issue is that the Auditor General made reference to foreign affairs. The DG of Foreign Affairs in 2004 came into that department, and there was a qualification. The qualification was related to reconciling the activities that financial activities that take place in forest missions through an account that was in the central bank. 500 million rands could not be reconciled. That was the qualification there. The DG phoned me, we had a meeting, I said, DG, that's a fact, it has been picked up by the Auditor General. It has to be in the report. We have to find a mechanism to deal with this issue going forward. The DG of Foreign Affairs did not say, I was not here when this issue happened. He did not say that. He said, okay, there's a challenge, I'll put in place mechanisms to deal with that challenge. I think within 2 years, if I'm right, that matter was dealt with and cleaned up in that report. So all it takes at the end of the day is the right attitude at the right level of leadership to make these things work. They are too basic for them to really not be resolved. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, perhaps I can, in handing back to you, just emphasize one message that is contained in this general report as well. I think it's been there for the last two reports that there is a need to look into a comprehensive strategy that will deal with the skills issue when it comes to the public sector. So, and that can happen unless the corridors of decision making assumes that responsibility together with the executive, along the lines that I guess Freeman has mentioned. Can I hand over back to you, Chair?
No, thank you very much, thank you. Let me start with the Honourable Member, Mabuni.
Thanks, Chair. Former Kamal from Insulting, Chairperson of Scopa. I want to find some plans. How material is going to come to a conclusion? Sometimes the NGO would say.
The bottom.
They said the bottom.
Not directly.
Okay. The difference of conclusions by the AG in terms of coming with an expression. You sometimes find a department unqualified with other matters, but the material or the amount of money that were included in other matters, you know, would be a significant amount of money. But sometimes in another department, they find that same amount of money is a reason for qualification. What is the material difference that you're using in coming to those conclusions?
The other part, Chair, would be the thing in housing we have banned things like lack of skills, capacity, lack of capacity, because our understanding is that budget, department of budget for those things. Don't come to us and say we don't have capacity to deal with certain things, or skills. This one, I think that one, the Accountant General should maybe say something on it, because we don't know what are doing with the availability of skills development fund that is there. If people need to be trained to be able to can meet the challenges of lack of skills in the department. The last or other thing is the one that is the performance audit, which you alluded to as a sign clicker. Is it that under? Because it might help us to refer our members, whether it goes to portfolio committee or public accounts committee, as and when it is referred.
for oversight purposes also. So, but if it is referred, does it have to go to SCOMPA or portfolio committee that will do, you know, oversight? Because I think if you say that it has some kind of connection to the budget cycle itself, but when is it happening for you to be dealt with?
Okay. Let me start right at the back. Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to add the Magma Sutan, Chairperson of the Standing Committee on the Audit General. I just wanted to highlight two key issues which come out very strongly. The first issue is culture, the question of the culture of impunity versus the culture of integrity. We can put up systems, we can write laws, procedures, we can put in skills. In fact, fraudsters are the most sophisticated and most skilled people. So you may find that the issue of skill does not necessarily respond to the question of consistent misappropriation and mismanagement of resources, public resources. I think at the political level we need to ask the question, how do we stand back and reflect on this and look at engaging with that issue politically? Because it's happening across various levels. One person once said to me that when he started working for some public agency, within a day, somebody brought an envelope. And when he refused, this person looked at him strangely to say, you know, where is this one coming from? Because this is the norm here. And he started becoming a threat, and somebody is obviously not very happy with you being there with that kind of attitude, because it means you're going to disrupt their operations, obviously. So I'm just saying, if this is how difficult it is, you get stopped by a traffic officer and they call you aside and they ask you certain questions that are not related to the discharge of their duty. That requires you to search your pockets. And it just becomes a culture that takes a life of its own. And where does it end? How do we politically begin to say, you know, at some point we need to take a step back and say, where are we going as a society? So I'm just flagging it as an issue which I think it needs a deeper political engagement. The second issue I want to flag relates to our collective responsibility as the lawmakers on the one hand and the executing authorities on the other, in the form of your ministers and MECs. Because you see, I think that even though at the theoretical level, in the constitution and law, we make law and the executive implement it or execute it. In reality, both us and the executive collectively exercise oversight. The people who really implement is the public service, starting with DG's downwards. And very often, the challenge may be if a portfolio committee or the legislative arm point out to flaws in the administration, the executing authority might feel it's a reflection on them and may adopt a defensive stance. And then you may have tensions between the two spheres. When, in fact, in my view, the executive should actually be seeing itself as being on the same side as the legislators in collectively discharging the oversight function. So that between us, ultimately the ruling party deploys all of us in all this. So there shouldn't be any contradiction. Ultimately, as a collective, we need to be able to sit together, sit with the enforcement, law enforcement entities such as the Auditor General, etc.
In conclusion,
sorry for that long term, but that is absolutely the key two points that I wanted to highlight. Thank you.
Honourable members, maybe just before you come in, Chief, we are taking the last round. This is the last round, and our intention is to finish at least by half past 12. There is that realization that two messages went out. The first one said the meeting was about to start, was going to start at 9. And then there's another notice that went out to say the meeting is starting at 10. So there are members who received, when the 9 o'clock notice, they made the applied arrangements by earlier. So we're just appealing to you that we won't go until half past 1. And lunch has been prepared, so that we don't want another wasteful expenditure in this exercise. Please just bear with us. And therefore, let's not follow the Honorable Masuta's route in engaging with the questions and with the AG. Thank you very much, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question hinges on the responsibilities of the General in terms of Chapter 9 of the Constitution. He has been able to outline some of the responsibilities that faces of now. The issue that I wanted to tease out is the issue of the recommendation that the Office of the Auditor General made in terms of the irregularities which have been discovered. I haven't heard in the past in the presentation from the Office of the Auditor General requiring of members to assist in ensuring that the Office of the Auditor General has the necessary power to define some of the irregularities within the department or local government as criminal. Because if a department comes to make a presentation to us, as Honorable Sochu has indicated, that for the past 5 years they have been having qualified reports, and then the department indicates that for the next 5 years they are going to continue with those type of reports which are qualified. Now, it is the question of whether there is capacity within those particular department, and where lies their duties and the role of the Auditor General in terms of capacity building. But now again, in a case of municipalities where it is clear that documents continue to disappear, and that the system of reporting are deliberately not followed. They are deliberately undermined. So I'm saying recommendations are made by the Office of the Auditor General. But what is it that it takes for them to be able to define some of the irregularities as being criminal offenses, which would be liable for persecution? Now, the last issue that I wanted to raise is the issue of this performance agreement. those could be contracts which are signed with the executive together with the civil servant when the director general assumes office. But I just want to find out what role is there for the auditor general. But in terms of the recommendations, I would like to find out if you have a relationship with the monitoring office, the monitoring committee in the office of the president. That office has been established in order to ensure that the delivery is being monitored from that center of whether the executive is capable of delivering on their own strategic plan and whether the budget are utilized properly. Now, I just want to understand if you have a relationship with that type of office, because it is quite essential in terms of the reports and documentation. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Last two hands. I see a hand here and a hand. Okay, last three. That will be the last that we're going to take. Okay, you may start.
Thank you, Chairman. Maybe one needs to start by appreciating and thanking the AG and his team for the presentation. However, it was my perception. I was expecting more than what the AG did. I was expecting a very basic report to us, the political leaders, which says, this is where we're coming from for 5 years. These are the problems that we have experienced from this province, or even if it doesn't coach the province, but coaching the problems that have been experienced by the AG, and how then us as political leaders we assist on that. That I think I was going to understand quite basic and know my role as to how to help, much as the accounting officer has highlighted that some of them I do understand that. And then secondly, really, it's just the recommendation that next time I will appreciate that approach of a presentation so that we get a feeling, because we're not there, as to what problems are you experiencing, both your account directly to the National Assembly, to the houses. And then two, it's a recommendation. You spoke about standardization because it was indicated earlier on. I'm just a bit worried. Yes, we do need standardization, but I would propose that if the AG can consider the schedule of the public entities, you know, we've got the one that are in Schedule 2 according to the PFMA and the one that are in Schedule 3. When you do those standardization evaluating or of monitoring, how are you going to separate? Because even if you look at the one in the Schedule 3 themselves, they're so miscellaneous, they're so mixed. Then lastly, unfortunately, we do not have your complete organogram. I would propose that within a division, if we can have, you know, we have a clear understanding as political leaders that within a division, there are experts or there are officials allocated per province, which gives us a better understanding for how does the performance information and performance auditing task is linked to the central that then comes back to us as is and not being covered. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Member? Yes.
I'm sorry, Chairperson. Thank you very much. Chair, let me join my colleagues in appreciating firstly the outreach for calling this particular gathering, and also thanking the Auditor General and the Office of the Accountant General from Treasury for the presentation and information. But I want to follow on what Comrade Lamine has just said, especially around the kind of information that would have really appreciated. I want to agree with that. would perhaps have appreciated even more if we would have had a presentation around the current challenges. Moreover, that when you look at the audit outcomes reports that we have in 2007, and most of the members I knew, both at the, from the legislatures and also from Parliament here. After saying that, I want to also congratulate the Auditor General for, you know, the type of audits that they're doing, both nationally and also internationally, especially at the UN level, because that puts us at a good level internationally. I just want to find out in relation to the performance audit. I heard the AG saying they are doing them on a cyclical basis. I just want to understand, is it per request? And if it's per request, who is actually supposed to commission such or to make such a request? Can a portfolio committee make a request if the need arises for such an audit, or is it at an executive level only? While I was appreciating the work done at an international level, is that also because we refer to shortage of skills? Is that not depleting our media resources, human resources, internally or domestically? Moreover, that we've been complaining, especially municipalities have been complaining about the lack of time as auditing. As a result, they are not able to keep up with the needs of the municipality, for them to be able to look at what transpired previously with an intention of improving. That has been a complaint previously. I'm not sure where is the complaint currently, but you know, if that's still a complaint, I don't know how much does our international work impact negatively on our internal work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Honourable Member. At the last hand,
mine is on management of assets. Majority of the departments are managing their assets through the Excel spreadsheet. And the AG is depicting a challenge on them. Now, my question is, what is the expectation of AG with regard to that management of assets through the Excel spreadsheet? My last question is on the issue of disclaimer versus the contract of service providers appointed by the AG. While we acknowledge the fact that most of the institutions are not managing their records correctly, but there is an observation that some of the information required by AG is towards the last few days of the appointment of the of that particular service provider. Now, as you provide that documentation that they require, they are no longer entertaining it because they are now wrapping up. And later they will come and say, a disclaimer, this institution got a disclaimer on these issues because they did not provide the necessary information. And yet the information has been provided, but they just could not accept it due to the fact that their contract is lapsed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The very last chief.
Thank you very much, Parliament as well, Zombule. Besides that, there was a question that was asked by Honorable Ntuli, the answer to which I didn't quite get. His question seemed to be, what sanctions taken or are imposed against a person who is found to be responsible for a continuous violation of rules and procedures that are laid down. Where you find that it has been reported on a continuous basis, department gets qualified, qualified support, and yet nothing happens. What exactly is there no remedy in terms of the law? Like, for instance, moving the person responsible for that. The accountant general, for instance, has allowed the work of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Department of Foreign Affairs, then, saying that it has to do with the right attitude on the part of the executive and the management of the department. What happens when there's a lack of that right attitude and right type of leadership? What sanctions are there? Because people seem to continue to be in their position for subsequent years while the same problem continues to be there.
No, thank you very much, AJ.
Thank you, Chair. I think in the interest of time, I'll try and handle these questions myself, and hopefully I'll be able to respond to them appropriately. Let me start with the very last one, which I would link to the issue of the classification of the irregularities in terms of the status that they deserve, be it criminal offences, etc., etc. And also the extent to which we are linking up with the Office of the President of Monitoring Evaluations and Administration. So I think those are all interrelated. That's including the issue around the culture of impunity, integrity, versus integrity, and the collective responsibility that needs to be considered to deal with this issue. Indeed, our reports are meant to highlight the extent of the repetitive nature of these findings. But our idea here has been deliberately meant to treat these issues on an incremental basis. Incremental in the sense that we needed in the last few reports to be clear about the diagnosis of the issue. I think we are now clear what is the problem. And the problem is the three issues that I've referred to. And the three issues that I've referred to are reflected equally in the general report that we have tabled, both for local government as well as for provincial government and national government. And the details relating thereto are contained in those reports for everyone to study and understand. But the root of the problem is around these three issues. And in any presentation that we would have made, we would have simply reflected those issues in the manner in which I have described them verbally. So we would not have deviated from this message, because that is what is the issue, and that's the beginning and the end of the issue in terms of our own analysis. And that's the deal with those issues. Chances are that we never go to move forward. Now, having said that, the next step is the engagement that we're having now to identify who should act on these issues, who should do something about them. So that we can attach responsibility. We're having a similar engagement with the executive as well, so that responsibility can be attached. If you read this report, especially the last year, has also had a detrimental element to it, because as opposed to the first one, we have now, after engaging with the legislature and the executive, recorded, I think, section, I can't remember, three or whatever, what the executive are committed to do. And in that section, we will also make a follow-up. If those things have not happened, so what? And this is where the oversight comes in handy, to know what the executive is committed to do, so that as part of the responsibility of the oversight, they can probe, follow up, and evaluate the progress that the executive is making on the promises that are recorded and documented in this report. In a manner that will confirm that we don't get to another audit cycle without those actions having been executed. And this is where the oversight responsibility becomes critically important. And for us, the evaluation of the next step will and should be informed by our further engagement. That will say, we have looked at the executive commitments, we have looked at the oversight commitments, we have come to the understanding that the reason why these things are not being actioned are as follows. If the leadership is not committed, the responsibility is not that of the Auditor General to execute action. It is that of the oversight to act politically about those issues. If at an official level the issue still continues, the responsibility is not that of the Auditor General, but that of the executive authority to exercise the necessary action. To the extent necessary, again, the Public Service Commission, administration, and the rules thereof have got provisions in this respect. There may be shortcomings and weaknesses here and there, but once again, it's up to us, the lawmakers, maybe rather say up to yourselves, the lawmakers, to strengthen that legislation, to strengthen those prescriptions, so that the proper action, sanctions, whether they are around strengthening the impunity or integrity, are appropriately applied. And that is the role that we believe we can play. Ours is to keep informed on the program. Yours is to act politically, because you have that constitutional responsibility to act jointly with the executive or unilaterally or whatever provided by the oversight prison to act on this information. But we will keep informed. We will not shy away from keeping informed. That's what we do. So in terms of, therefore, the impact and the effect of continuous transgressions, that's where we can that's the role that we can play. But in addition to this, in touching on the role of the presidency unit that is responsible for monitoring, evaluation, and administration, we have had a session with the minister. I have had a discussion with him to make an input to the priorities of that ministry, and have got an understanding that the trends that we are building up in our report and the format in which we perhaps even classify them and position them, that comes back to the question of the classification that was raised earlier, would be some of the issues that we could consider, depending on what is expected of us. But we may have successes and limitations in terms of our ability to make these classifications in an informed manner. Maybe the Public Service Commission would be best placed to help with that kind of classification. But what we do with excellence is to articulate the root of the problem, whether it can be classified as criminal or otherwise, or attitudinal. I think it should be informed by our collective engagement to then make that call, either scopers or portfolio committees, executive, jointly or from separately. But I do take the point that it's something that needs to be done. Our submission and our participation in that study group is about also defining that the kind of work we are doing as part of our research in the office, the kind of level of tolerance and sanctions that should be associated and linked to those levels of transgression and tolerance, depending on the nature, the extent to which they are repeated, etc., etc. We are also involved in that kind of exercise, and at some point we will be making those inputs to the ministry's study group, and out of that, hopefully by end of September, October, I don't know when he's going to pronounce on his priorities, we would have made our input in that respect. But our input will also continue in the form of the kind of information that we provided here today to help with the sanctions. We will honestly be very excited as an office if something could be done about the kind of findings that we make, because to make them repetitive is not the most motivating scenario for the audience. So I like this kind of tone to take us forward. Chair, if I can just highlight that today indeed is never and was never meant to be a day for presenting the information in detail. The intention was to set a date by when we will do that. We are currently studying and analyzing the report of 2009 year end. That date, end of September, beginning of October, will be the date where we will present the results, comparative analysis with the past, slice and dice it in a manner as best possible and simple for this grouping to understand. So that information will be taken throughout the provinces as part of our roadshow to once again trigger the action that needs to follow as a result of that analysis. So to take note of the request to present this information in a different manner, we shall do so once we've found the date sometime in September. And in October, you're welcome to join us in the provincial roadshows as well. So we'll be unpacking this information with the entire provincial layout as well. I think, Chair, that leaves me with now the specific questions that I need just to quickly respond to. Which are technical by nature, some administrative. One technical one is, I suppose, the issue of our consideration of materiality and why the finding in one department becomes a qualification and another department becomes treated differently as an other matter or emphasis or whatever. All I can say is it all depends on the significance of the issues that we're dealing with, because as an audit, as Mr. McQuaid has highlighted, an audit is about an expression of opinion on the fairness of presentation, not on the accuracy of presentation. So in a department that has got a multiple billion in terms of its budget versus a department that has got millions, a transgression of 100,000 will be treated differently. In a multi-billion department, that is a non-issue. But in a million department, it is an issue, because then it misleads materially the results that are being presented. But the way in which we make sure that it doesn't get swept under the carpet, we look at the reason, even in the billion department, for that transgression to have taken place. And if the underlying cause, because of the lack of systemic integrity, we then note it and log it under other matters so that it doesn't get lost. Because if that continues unhindered, it will continue to erode the integrity of that government. So that's the kind of evaluation we do, and we apply our professional judgment in making that kind of assessment. And that is why we always emphasize, as we have responded earlier, that whether the department is unqualified, as long as we've got other matters, that is very serious. It's got to be taken seriously. In terms of the assessment audit referral, I'll combine this very quickly with the basics on which we may be making these choices. The choice of which assessment audit to do has in the past been on the basis of requests that provinces may make, or departments may make. We have changed that process, and all part of our own call in terms of what is of national interest. We have now established a process where we look at holistically the terrain and the issues that are of national interest, as I've indicated, coming from various sources, state of the nation, et cetera, and do an evaluation and then choose those that we believe will serve the nation best. At the moment, we have got some permanent audit that is selected, which are contained in our annual report. If you go to our annual report, you will see which ones those are. So that's what we do at the moment. In terms of consultation, we will every year consult not only with the executive once we've done the analysis, but consult with this committee. So the strengthening of our relationship with the committee, I think, is important from that perspective as well. So that when we make those choices, we make them having done wide consultation. I think the last question is make sure that I've covered all of them. Yeah, there's quite a bit of them. I've tried to consolidate all of them. But the last one, if I may, relates better to our capacity that we allocate to the international terrain and the impact that that may have on the on our ability to fulfill our local mandate. There's no impact whatsoever in that respect. The backlog that was associated with local government was something beyond the profession's ability to respond to in the last 2 years. But we have now cleared every backlog in local government. And as of the last audit of local government, we're able to finish all local government audits. Pretty much in time for their completion. So that resource is fundamentally important, in fact, for us to expose us to the international environment and also help us to attract skills that are required in the public sector. It's the only tool we have to compete with the private sector who have got international links. As an audit office and as a public sector, we don't have any other links or international work, and that's the only tool we're going to recruit that we can use to attract our students to be interested in the work. But it is not in any way impacting on our ability. In fact, the amount of work we do internationally does not exceed 2% of the work that we do entirely in the country. Our target is to make that never to exceed 5% of our capacity. So we're still well way within our limit in terms of what we can afford. So can I just quickly, if I'm not missing anyone out, I think this one is worth responding to in terms of the audit process and our cutoff and the impact thereof on the disclaimers. And it's a matter that we have been addressing over the last 2 years with regard to the audit process. Departments, municipalities are aware by now that when we start the audit, key officials have got to be available for the audit. If they have been available throughout the audit, we have been very sympathetic in understanding when issues arise at the last moment to at least give them an extension to complete those audits. However, if the key officials have chosen to stay away from the audit, for whatever reason, whether it's municipal managers or heads of departments who are not sympathetic at all when we receive information on the last day, we're going to cut off and reflect on the fact that the information could not be available in the time we were able to audit. they will have to catch up on that issue next audit cycle. If you look at the same general report, we have got there an indication of the extent to which officials and government are better performing. There's still a high number of key officials not making themselves available for audit, and that's the worrying trend. And we've been very insistent on the fact that most of the disclaimers, most of the qualifications are never as a result of information not being there, but as a result of key officials, leaders not taking the audit seriously. We need to drive that trend to zero so that we can make sure that community is not shortchanged in terms of the results of the audit. I think the asset issue is basically an issue that we can respond to in terms of the support that Treasury will provide in looking at the systems that are associated around asset management. The use of spreadsheets has been an alternative that has been workable in the short term. I've used Limpopo as an example. When there was a total collapse in the asset system in Limpopo, that's the best alternative they could opt for as a province, and it has worked wonderfully. In that province, as a short-term measure. In other settings, local government or municipalities, that could well be an alternative in the meantime, while perhaps systems that could assist in capturing assets for local government are being reviewed, investigated through the treasury process. But there are workable alternatives in the absence of anything to the contrary. I think I've covered most of the issues. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Longwell, I wanted to make a quick intervention. 2 seconds.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Just on the question Honorable Minister raised around the criminality. Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 of the PFMA, and there's a similar provision in the MFMA, deals with the responsibilities of the accounting officer and the responsibilities of the accounting authority. And there's some sanctions that are mentioned in those provisions when there's non-compliant specific provisions. And Chapter 10 of the PFMA then covers much more broadly that issue of financial misconduct and what are the penalties that are attendant to that. So to the extent that these activities, these repeated non-compliance is an issue, it is already dealt with as a non-compliance with the legislation as criminal in the PFMA and in the MFMA. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much for that quick intervention. Without wasting any time, can I then give the House Chairperson, Honorable Oliphant, to give a vote of thanks?
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members, I've been given 10 minutes, and therefore I'm going to use the whole 10 minutes. Firstly, I would like to thank all members who are here today, including the Office of the Auditor General, and also to thank the office for the presentation that we have just had. As the Auditor General has said, this is not the last session. I therefore request the Office of the House Chairperson that deals with oversight, Honorable Babela and Honorable Dao, to coordinate the next session. And by that session, I would appeal that it should not be on a Friday, because everybody seems rushing to the airport. So you have to negotiate with the chairpersons of portfolio committees and select committees. You must learn to negotiate as well. I think also as committees we need to synchronize our programs, particularly when we are having the public hearings at a committee level, where we can say all committees, the NSOP, the NA, and also from the legislatures can come together for a certain public hearing where MECs and ministers and officials from those departments should also participate. On the issue of skills development that were raised by members, I think that was a very important issue. And I believe that as legislators, we have a right and responsibility to come up with the legislation that will assist the government to employ the correct people for the correct job. And by doing so, we'll be protecting the public purse so that at the end of the day, delivery should happen. So we are also we also have that responsibility. And finally, since we are public representatives, everybody knows that we represent the public. And as committees as well, we need to allow the public to participate through committees. And therefore, we must come also with a strategy on how we will allow the public hearings and public meetings in various areas to take place where public can participate. And by doing so, we will be fulfilling the clause of the Freedom Charter that the government that we have is the government and the legislature and the parliament of the people, by the people and for the people, by interacting with the public. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Oliphant. Just two announcements, very brief one. One is the chairperson of the Appropriation Committee, Honorable Sokoli, and together with the finance chairperson, they will be having a workshop next week on the with the National Treasury on the Public Finance Management Act and the Municipal Finance Management Act from 9 o'clock to 13 hours on Wednesday, the 19th August. E249, they are inviting chairpersons of portfolio committees and select committees at the national level so far, we are excluding provinces, to please join them so that you could also familiarize yourself with that tool of oversight as far as party finance and the municipal finance management is concerned. So they are invited as chairpersons. Then the lunch is served in the old assembly, the dining hall, so we'll also sit there, and we'll also be having some nice choir singing for you as you entertain yourself with their lunch. Honorable Sojo.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Those two chairs must learn to negotiate, because those chairs pledges our portfolio committee meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.